¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams sale and get 30% off Duration, Woodscapes, and SuperDeck products May 1st through the 11th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hi, everyone. It's Kendall.
And Josh from Mile Higher Media.
And as most of you guys know, last September, we launched our foundation, the Higher Hope Foundation. And honestly, it's been pleasantly surprising how much we have been able to do in our first year, thanks to all of you. The amount of grants that we have been able to offer to victims, families of victims, as well as similar-minded nonprofits in the advocacy space. It's just been an amazing first year.
Yeah, we just wanted to thank you so much for all of your support out there, whether you've given a donation, whether you've purchased merch, which again, all merchandise at milehighermerch.com, 100% of proceeds goes to the Higher Hope Foundation. So that's been absolutely huge for the foundation since we've made that change. But also just by viewing our content, listening to our content, or supporting any of our sponsors, all of that goes into funding the grants that the Higher Hope Foundation is able to give.
And so far in 2025, we've disbursed over $210,000 in grants, scholarships, and projects, and we've also processed over 25 grants.
And right now, we are in our season of giving, and we're only $40,000 shy of reaching our full impact goal. So obviously, we'd love to meet this goal, and we intend to meet this goal. Closing this gap means helping 8 more families or organizations that are still waiting for the help that they deserve.
And so every gift, no matter the size, and by the way, every single cent that you donate goes directly to grants, 100% of that. And every little bit of it makes a huge difference for us and will help people who are still waiting.
And during our season of giving, we're going to be matching every dollar up to $50,000 of donations that are made during this time. And if we reach our goal, we'll also reach our year-end impact goal, which will be huge for the foundation and huge for all of those out there who need help.
Yeah, and it will allow us to start 2026 strong.
You can get involved directly and place a donation over at higherhope.org/donate, or you can start your own fundraiser and get your family, your friends, your coworkers involved over at higherhope.org/get involved.
Thank you and happy holidays.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
And we're back, this time in 2026, believe it or not.
Yeah, wow.
New year, new me.
Damn.
Austin just realized it's a new year.
Oh, no.
It's a new year, and who knows what lies ahead?
For real.
A lot of unknowns.
Yeah.
But today, a case that's, I feel like, largely unknown to a lot of us Americans. I hadn't heard of it, actually, which is kind of surprising. The Setagaya Massacre. And this is a case that comes from Tokyo, Japan, also known as the Goldilocks Murders. This is the largest unsolved homicide case in Japanese history, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And this beautiful, perfectly normal, kind, friendly family mysteriously was murdered the night before New Year's Eve. And obviously, things like this just don't happen all that often in Japan especially. Yeah, and so this was huge, huge case. Tons of coverage, tons of police working on this. Somewhat 250,000 officers, which is like, how do you even wrap your mind around that?
Yeah. And so we just passed the, that would make the 25th anniversary, actually. Yeah.
That's a lot of... It's just wild that it's unsolved still. They still don't know who the killer was.
And they have so much evidence as well, but they just... They've never been able to narrow it down.
Especially since there was a good amount of evidence left behind.
A ton.
They... Not... Yeah, it makes you wonder... Was this person even from Japan? Did they flee the country? Like, what happened here? I mean, they haven't been able to actually identify the killer. But this is a absolutely crazy one, and an important one at that. I mean, obviously the family's still looking for answers and what happened all these years later. But yeah, I figured it'd be a good case to start the year off with. So yeah, with that being said, let us get into the Setagaya Massacre. Today's case takes place in Kamisoshigaya, a suburban neighborhood in Setagaya, Tokyo. And in 2000, this peaceful area continued to see the rapid expansion of Tokyo and was considered a transitioning area. A lot of things are happening, a lot of construction, a lot of new neighborhoods. And for about 10 years before, many in the neighborhood had vacated and sold their properties to the local government. They wanted to expand the nearby Soshigaya Park, and the idea was to make an area where the growing community could come together. But the new expansion of the park came with more skateboarders, those skaters, whose noise frustrated the nearby neighbors at the edge of the expanding park because they're just hitting all the rails constantly.
Yep.
This included 44-year-old Mikio Miyazawa, whose house was very close to the skate park, and he lived there with his 41-year-old wife Yasuko, and their two children, 8-year-old Nina and 6-year-old Ray. And the family moved into the house in 1990, when there were 200 houses nearby. And by 2000, the family lived in one of four homes that still existed in the remaining complex. Most had either been sold or demolished at this point, and the land was then added to the park. Only one of the other houses was inhabited. Reportedly, all of the inhabitants, including the family in the complex, had agreed to sell their homes to the local government. So it's kind of empty.
Yeah.
Other than a few people, which I think also plays a big factor in this case, as we'll see later on. But the children's mother, Yasuko, wanted to delay their move considering how it would affect her children. The Miyazawas lived in a cramped three-story home, and we have the kind of a rough floor plan, which is also important to take a look at if you're watching. But the bottom floor was a garage on one side and a storage room and a home office on the other. The second floor contained the kitchen, living room, bathroom, and the kids' bedroom where they slept in bunk beds. And then the third floor was an attic that acted as a bedroom for the parents, which was accessible by a small ladder. It's kind of like it's a three-story home, kind of tri-level situation. And from the outside, it looked like one large house.
Yeah, and it's kind of shared walls with the unit
kind
next
of a
door.
Duplex-ish type situation.
A lot of people get confused because it's like, oh, a three-story home, that must be huge. But it's not exactly, because they're technically just using the attic as a bedroom.
Right.
And then it's pretty close quarters inside the home as well.
Because the kids are in the actual bedroom.
Yes. Yeah.
And then they just repurpose the attic.
Exactly.
And like Austin said, from the outside, it does kind of look like one large house, but it's two residences that are attached side by side. Next door within the same complex was a home owned by Yasuko's sister, Anne, and Anne's husband. Anne and her husband often lived abroad, and their mother, Haruko, the children's maternal grandmother, occupied that home. Thick soundproofing separated the two homes even though they were attached, which is also important as we go further through this here. Mikio, the father who worked for an English advertising company called Interbrand, which was a company that popularized the word Wi-Fi, actually.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
But he loved animation, and in school he took part in puppetry and play productions. Just kind of a creative guy. Yasuko worked as a cram school teacher, similar to a home tutor. Some sources claim she taught children out of her home. Others claim that she also made house visits. Their daughter Nina was in second grade in public school, and she took piano lessons and loved dancing ballet. She also loved to show her paternal grandmother, Setsuko, her dance moves. And their son Ray had a developmental disorder and attended public kindergarten. The family gave him tons of love and support. And generally, the family was known as a tight-knit one. And as upstanding members of their community, they didn't really have any known disputes or enemies. By all accounts, Mikio had been seen yelling at the skaters in the park to quiet down, But I mean, that's probably not the only one.
Yeah.
If it's bothering him, there's probably others. And again, just yelling at some skaters, what is that going to do? What are they going to do, rather? But again, just something to keep in mind. And Yasko had complained about cars parking too close to their home, but other than that, they were a friendly family who got along with most people. One of Mikio's coworkers said that Mikio was a congenial man who got on well with everyone. Definitely not the sort of person to make enemies.
On December 30th, 2000, like many families in Tokyo at that time, the Miyazawas were preparing for their New Year's celebrations. They went shopping and later went home to eat dinner and relax just before bed. So before we get into things too deep here, it's important to note that the exact timeline of events that unfolded inside the home is not very clear. Different publications, many of them translated from Japanese, as well as police press releases, and just the overall mystery of the case, all of those components contribute to an inconsistent timeline of events. So what we'll tell you today is just the best theory that investigators have kind of put together on what transpired inside the home. So that night, the entire family was inside the home, and around 9 or 10 p.m., the family received a call on the home phone, and by then it's believed that everything in the house was perfectly calm. The only reliable timestamp for the intruder was when someone who wasn't a family member logged onto the home computer at 1:18 a.m., and they spent only 5 minutes logged onto this computer. So that is really the only thing that's given us a time frame whatsoever for this entire case, which is kind of hard to wrap your head around.
But specifically of when there was an intruder in the house.
Yes, exactly.
So they could have been in there hours before. I mean, we have no idea.
Hours after, yeah. So by the next morning, December 31st, Yasuko's mother, Haruko, who we mentioned earlier, she lived that next door. She had called the house phone several times, but there was no answer. Figuring something was wrong, she decided to go check on them, and she entered the home a little after 10 a.m. When she entered through the front door, she first saw Mikio's bloodied body at the base of the first floor stairs. She then discovered the rest of the family dead inside the home, upstairs on the second floor. She touched them, hoping to find signs of life, but there were none, so she immediately called emergency services at 10:58 a.m. Some have suggested that the intruder might have entered through the front door, since it's unknown if it was open or not. Haruko was unsure if she unlocked the front door that morning. I believe she first told investigators that she did unlock it, but she then couldn't recall it later on. So there is a big question if the front door was unlocked or not.
It's kind of, yeah, it's a huge detail.
Yeah.
That you'd hope someone would remember if it was unlocked.
Right.
That would be like, oh, that was weird. Why was their door unlocked? But right. Maybe that's something they did. I don't know.
True. And if it was unlocked, did it just mean the culprit exited through there? They may not have entered through there. So there's still a debate among investigators about how the culprit actually entered and maneuvered through the home. But they've pieced things together. And as we mentioned, Mikio was found at the base of the stairs on the first floor, kind of towards the back of the home. Yasuko was found on the second floor, hunched near the attic ladder and staircase beside her daughter Nina. And her son, Ray, was found kind of around the corner in the bottom bunk of the bunk bed in that bedroom. And all of them had been stabbed to death except for the son, Ray, who had been strangled. Investigators believe that on the night of December 30th, an intruder entered the home around 11 p.m., most likely through a small second-story window into the bathroom that was above the bathtub. The size and height of the window suggests that the intruder had significant upper body strength, and he most likely used the park fence near the house to assist in reaching the window. We have a photo we can throw up there. It's a pretty high fence here, so you can see how someone could climb up there and then reach over to that small second-story window. After the intruder was inside, one common theory suggests that the intruder first entered the children's bedroom, which was right around the corner from the bathroom. Here, the perpetrator strangled Ray to death in his bunk bed. His sister had been sleeping upstairs on the top floor in her parents' bed with her mother, Yasuko, at that time. It's then believed the perpetrator went down to the first floor where Mikio was, He may have been the only family member that was awake at that time, and he was finishing up work on the home computer. Other sources claim that Mikio may have heard the commotion upstairs and found the intruder at the top of the stairs on the second floor. Either way, the intruder wielded a sashimi knife, which is a knife used for preparing seafood, quite long and very sharp. A physical altercation occurred and Mikio was stabbed multiple times. It's believed he may have fell or was pushed down the stairs where he landed on the first floor near the home office and then bled out from his wounds. Another scenario has been proposed where Mikio might have been attacked on the first floor, tried to flee up the stairs, and later fell down and then bled out. One of his slippers was found on the staircase, suggesting that he was most likely on them at some point during this altercation, but a fragment of that sashimi knife was later discovered embedded in his skull. This is a very important fact to remember because it also lends to the quality of the knife. After killing Mikio, the intruder then discarded the broken sashimi knife and grabbed another knife from the family's kitchen. Next, the intruder accessed the attic bedroom by the ladder and attacked Yasuko and Nina, who were in the futon bed where bloodstains were later discovered. They might still have been asleep when the intruder entered the room, but it's unknown exactly what was going on. But the intruder then likely stabbed them to death up there in the attic bedroom, and it's widely believed that Yasuko and Nina tried to escape through that foldable ladder that was the only way to access the attic, but they were killed along the way. Yasuko's body showed defensive wounds, indicating that she had most likely tried to fight off that attacker until the very end. And their bodies, Nina's and Yasuko's, were found at the bottom of the ladder near the top of the staircase on the second floor. That makes sense. A newsletter reported, "At the scene was a sea of blood. The mother was lying on the ground protecting her daughter." Investigators discovered that Nina, who was the daughter, was also missing several teeth. Investigators concluded that she had been stabbed and physically beaten even after she was already dead, which shows a certain amount of aggression towards her specifically. She was also the last of the family members to die. According to Officer Takeshi Tsushida, he said, "When I think about the brutality and the way he murdered the four, I just wonder, how could a sane person carry out such an extreme crime? He slashed them from above the chest to the face as if he tormented them. It was extremely brutal. And the way he finished them off in the very end, it was so horrific we couldn't show those scars to the devastated victims' families. There are no other cases in which the victims have been cut up like this." So extremely brutal in the killings here. And
did they ever release autopsy reports or anything for these guys?
I never saw any official ones. I think Japan has a very strict personal, so it's really just through police press reports that they release information.
But regardless, just from that description, it's very clear this is a horrible, horrible end, extremely brutal, clearly a crime of passion, because I mean, for somebody to go into a residence, most, I feel like armed robbers would even do the things that this person did to right. these children, especially.
Yeah.
And just the brutality of it, you know, and it makes me wonder, I'm like, does it seem more brutal because it was a knife as opposed to a gun? But then thinking about Japan, much harder to have to get a gun. So right. this is an easier weapon to obtain. When I just try to think about what kind of person could have done this and why.
Yeah.
It's really hard to pinpoint that because it doesn't seem like this person came in there for any other reason than to brutally murder them.
Right.
The entire family.
Yeah, I think that's
like important. A revenge killing or something.
Yeah. And it's important to remember that, you know, for whatever reason, it seemed like his aggression was directed at the daughter.
Yeah.
The youngest daughter, because she was missing teeth. She had been attacked after she had already died. So yeah, seems like a pretty sick individual here.
And what makes these killings even more bizarre and what drew media attention to the case was the fact that investigators believe that this killer stayed inside the home possibly for hours after the entire family was dead. The media gave the case the nickname the Goldilocks Murders, which, as most of us know, is a reference to the old British fairy tale where Goldilocks, an intruder, stays inside the home
of the three bears and abuses their things, eats their porridge.
You know, sleeps in their bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After the murders, investigators tracked the movements of the intruder as best as they could. It's understood that the killer walked down the ladder, past the bodies, went into the kitchen where he retrieved a few cartons of ice cream from the fridge. He also drank some barley tea and ate some melon. So after just brutalizing this family, they just go and eat some ice cream and have some tea.
Yeah.
Which,
pretty heartless.
Yeah. Right? It's just evil, man. The killer did not use a spoon. Instead, the cartons of ice cream were found squeezed. He's just like squeezing it out like a go-gurt or something. And bites were also taken out of it. The intruder left their saliva and fingerprints behind on several different items. After eating, the intruder then rifled through the kitchen to find a first aid kit. He used a Band-Aid from the kitchen, bandages from the family first aid kit, and even Yasko's sanitary pads to bandage his wound. Because that's the other thing too. This type of attack, that particular knife, when you look at it, he's cutting himself like crazy.
Sure.
With that knife. There's nothing stopping him from the knife slipping through into his hands and on him. And also these people are, you know, that he's killing are fighting back. And he's probably pretty messed up from this as well. Hence him looking for all these bandages. And what's crazy is that these bandages were left behind, which gave investigators ample amounts of blood samples. So you're probably thinking like they've got to have so much DNA. There's stuff all over the place. Why is this unsolved? The killer then exited the kitchen, headed downstairs to a small storage room. Once in there, he rummaged through the family's documents and pulled out an entire drawer from one of the shelving units. He took that drawer up to the second floor bathroom and dumped the contents into the bathtub before defecating in the toilet and not flushing. He also smeared his blood on the bathroom towel, leaving a significant amount of DNA behind. So, not only did the killer leave behind fingerprints, shoe prints, as well as blood, stool, and saliva samples, but he also removed some of his clothing. He left behind his jacket, his hat, his shirt, and scarf. He also left two handkerchiefs, one with a hole in it, a fanny pack or hip bag, a pair of gloves, traces of cologne, and both the knives he used as murder weapons. So literally
everything. Yeah.
What isn't there?
Right.
Other than him or her. It's wild. It's all the evidence any detective could ever want when it comes to a murder. It's all there. Some sources then claim that the killer went to sleep on the couch in the second story living room and left sometime that morning. So after doing all of this, they just went and took a nap.
Yeah, so bizarre.
Unbelievable. And just a reminder, the chronology of all these events is uncertain. The only definitive timestamp on the case is when the intruder accessed the family's home computer at 1:18 a.m. for 5 minutes. This was confirmed in 2018 by a former investigator on the case. Apparently, the killer created a new folder on the computer, and we don't know why, but other sources claim that he used the internet to access the website of a local theater company, and some claim he was even looking at tickets for the show.
What?
Which, if that's all true, then this person was just casually, you know, not how do I cover this up? Not anything related
what am I going to do tomorrow?
Yeah. Planning out their week or something. The computer was turned on again around 10 a.m., according to the same former investigator, which meant the killer may have been in the house for nearly 10 hours, which is wild. But it was later determined that the computer mouse was most likely bumped by Yasko's mother, Haruko, when she entered the home and found the bodies.
We still don't know for sure, though.
But yeah, it's possible it was the intruder.
Yeah.
But obviously, something like this was going to gain a ton of media attention. I mean, this is just absolutely brutal. Whole family, children are dead. It's just bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. All the things left. And for somebody who does something like this to just stay behind for that much time rather than just get in and out is truly weird. Investigators believe the killer probably left soon after accessing the home computer after 1 a.m. But again, there's just so much they don't know. And with all the evidence that had been left behind, a former senior official said, the crime scene was a mountain of treasure and everyone thought a solution would not be far away. And in hindsight, many wondered if the New Year's holiday had delayed a proper investigation. Many officers had been at home at the time of the murders and it actually took police days to send over a full investigation team, which is
New Year's Eve, right? Yeah.
Which is just weird and very unfortunate because had they handled this better from the beginning, maybe it'd be solved. But it was the holidays. And again, they probably weren't used to something like this taking place. But
right. But the police, they processed every single piece of evidence they could find to try and narrow down who the killer was. Since the killer left his clothes behind and the footprints narrowed down his shoes, the police were able to assemble a visual of the killer. And they kind of posted this on the news and everything. You can see what he looks like if you have visuals on our show. Kind of what a bucket hat type thing, a jacket. They even narrowed down his shoes because it was through the footprints, and they got his size as well. But they were hoping that any eyewitness had seen a man who looked like this. And they were also hoping that the vast amount of DNA would easily connect the suspect to the scene. They assembled a physical profile of the killer, but Japan's laws surrounding DNA privacy and privacy in general are very strict, especially compared to the U.S. here. And the DNA testing was done by an internal organization. Since the investigation was so high profile, some of that DNA information has been released to the public. The DNA evidence concluded that the killer had mixed ancestry and his mother was most likely from Europe, possibly the Mediterranean or the Adriatic Sea, and his father had East Asian ancestry with markers in 1 in 13 Japanese people, 1 in 10 Chinese people, and 1 in 4 Korean people. It's estimated that the perpetrator was a man between the ages of 15 and 35. He was about 5'7" and slim, although strong. And they figured he was slim because that fanny pack or the hip bag was 32 inches around. And they figured he was strong because they thought he pulled himself into that second story window. He was a male with type A blood. And from his stool, they determined even which last meal he ate, which contained string beans and sesame seeds. They also deduced that the killer was most likely right-handed and often wore baggy clothing. Investigators did not find any match to their DNA evidence or the fingerprints in their database. This suggests that the killer had no criminal record before murdering an entire family in cold blood. Unfortunately, much of the evidence led nowhere, and most of the clothing and items left behind were not that unique. The sweatshirt the killer left was only manufactured and sold 130 times, making it kind of rare, but officers have only ever been able to track down 12 owners. Luckily, there was a small break in the case when two items of clothing revealed a few more clues. Those shoes that I mentioned earlier were Slazenger sneakers, 27.5 centimeters. And they were not from Japan. They were manufactured in South Korea, and the specific 27.5 centimeter size shoes were never sold in Japan, only in South Korea. So this suggested that the perpetrator lived in or visited Korea at some time in their life, but all South Koreans and tourists over the age of 17 in South Korea must provide their fingerprints. Unfortunately, there were no fingerprints that matched the ones found inside the home to the fingerprints in the South Korean National Database. How that can happen, I have no idea, unless if this was possibly someone under the age of 17, which is a theory out there, but you would think that would have been a ace in the hole right there. Oh, these shoes are only from South Korea, and if you basically enter the country of South Korea, your fingerprints are on record, yet like a ghost, there were no connections there.
So unless this person received the shoes some other way,
right?
They never actually went into the country.
That's
they knew
possible.
Somebody in South Korea who sent them the shoes or something.
It's possible.
It's the only thing
maybe
I can think
of. Family there or something.
Yeah.
That DNA did come back 1 in 4 markers when they ran the DNA test for Korea. But yeah, who knows? There might be some loopholes here. Another clue came from the fanny pack or that hip bag. Police found grip tape for skateboards inside the bag, as well as the previously mentioned cologne. They even narrowed down the cologne to the exact smell. And here's the crazy part. There were also trace amounts of sand inside the bag. And the investigators determined that the sand was not even from Japan. It was from California City, just north of Los Angeles, California.
That's
which is
huge.
Crazy. Yeah. They can narrow down sand like that. But hoping to stir up any memories in potential eyewitnesses, the police also later released information about what was happening that day and even that year, including what was on TV that night, just to stir up anything that people could remember as time went on, because the investigation was going nowhere. When investigators had canvassed the area right after the murders, they interviewed a cab driver who claimed they picked up three men in the area near the family's home. The cab driver said that all three men fit the general age and build of the perpetrator. The cab driver also mentioned that one of the men must have been injured because he left behind a blood stain on the back seat. Fortunately, investigators were unsure if these men were connected to the crime, since it's believed that there was only one perpetrator inside that home, not three. Eyewitnesses also came forward from a medical center in the Tobu Niko station, a few hours north of the family home. Nurses and staff claimed they spoke to a man in his mid-30s who had a severe injury on his hand. It looked like a wound, possibly from a knife that cut down to the bone. If you remember, our perpetrator had an injury and he left blood all over the crime scene and he tried to treat the wound inside. And the man that was at this medical center refused to tell medical staff how he received the injury, which raised suspicions. But unfortunately, this line of investigation led nowhere. Police had also looked into one of the handkerchiefs recovered from the crime scene, specifically the one that had a hole cut in the middle of it. And they asked the public if they had any idea why a handkerchief would ever be cut in this way. Apparently, people came forward and said fishermen used it as a trick to put the end of a knife handle through to get a better grip on the knife for cutting into a fish like tuna. I've never really heard of this before, but I was going to ask Daniel, have you cut a lot of fish before? Does this sound familiar?
Actually, I used to work at a fish restaurant and I never did this trick specifically, but I have used the knives that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that the reason they put the handkerchief on like that is because since they're working at the docks or working with fish, their hands are probably wet. So it's probably just to give them a better grip because the handles are wood.
Sure.
So if your hands are wet, they're a little slippery. So I don't have any personal experience with this trick, but I can see why it would be beneficial.
You can understand it. Yeah. Others suggested it was used to prevent fingerprints from appearing on the handle, but that's kind of bogus because the perpetrator left his fingerprints virtually everywhere around the scene. Others suggested the intact handkerchief was used to cover his face to conceal his identity, but ultimately this investigation in the handkerchiefs really led nowhere. And then what's really bizarre is on April 9th, 2001, so the following year, a few months later, and that was actually 100 days after the murder, a stone 11-centimeter tall Buddhist statue was found on the opposite side of Senekawa River. This was located to the west of the family's home, and investigators considered whether the statue had anything to do with the murders. On the bottom, they found an inscription of the character that means six in Chinese. But this was entered into evidence because they thought possibly there was some connection between the statue and the murders.
Yeah, or maybe it was just somebody who is, you know, paying their respects or something, or it was some type of memorial place there. But yeah, it could be something pertaining to the perpetrator possibly. Yeah, it's just bizarre. I mean, my mind goes all over the place here because in my mind, I feel like this is somebody who has never done this before because of the fact that they left DNA everywhere. There's all this evidence everywhere. They panicked. They ditched all their stuff.
They even injured themselves.
They injured themselves.
It wasn't
they used
clean.
A knife that is not a good knife for
broke.
If you're going to stab somebody.
Yeah.
A sushi knife is not the knife to use.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing stopping your hand from sliding on the blade. Because like when you look at other stabbings and you look at the knives that are used, oftentimes there'll be sort of a stopper there, you know?
Yeah, or at least a better grip on the
handle. Or a better grip, you know, something wrapped around it. But it's just such a brutal crime that it's really hard to wrap your mind around, could this have been a first-time killer? And what would have caused them to do this? What would cause somebody to just go berserk and kill an entire family? Did they kill? Were they
targeting somebody in there? Like, it's just, there's so many questions. It just doesn't make sense. And was this person even from Japan, or was it somebody visiting? The grip tape for the skateboards, the fact that Mikio's yelling at skateboard, you know, there's all these other little things that my mind is going to, but police released detailed information pertaining to the case, hoping that it would spark some memory or connection with someone in the public. A reward up to 20 million yen was offered for any information that could lead to the killer. But unfortunately, despite this, the case went cold, and it is still unsolved to this day, believe it or not. And since the case has remained unsolved for over two decades, many theories have been proposed, of course. One common theory is that this is a burglary gone wrong. And really, the simple idea is that the intruder entered the home with the intention of stealing things, and when he was caught, ran into Mikio, things got violent. They came prepared. They brought a knife with them in the event, possibly, that somebody was still awake, that they were ready to act on it. But as we see, that doesn't really happen all that much. Because most burglars target houses when there is no one at home. They don't want to escalate this to murder. Yeah,
exactly. Or them getting killed.
Yeah, or them ending up hurt and cut and bleeding everywhere.
Right.
That they would wait till they're not home. So the fact that this was not the case kind of disproves this theory. It just doesn't make sense why they would risk it. And also the way that they entered seems to me like it'd be kind of loud, possibly. They're like jumping from the fence to the roof to into the window.
Yeah.
It just, it happens though. It definitely happens, but it does seem kind of like a rare thing. Plus, if the goal was only to steal items from the home, why would they have gone into the children's bedroom first? Where, you know, there's nothing in there that they want. They're not there for toys or anything.
You're not keeping money in the kids' room. Yeah.
So is it possible that that's just the window they went into? And why would they murder someone, just children in general, and someone as young as Ray, who's just completely defenseless? I mean, it's just such a brutal thing to do.
Yeah.
And unnecessary, too.
Yeah. And he has a developmental disorder. Like, I don't know. Yeah. What would be the point of that in a burglary gone wrong scenario? It makes no sense.
And then if we look further, the perpetrator only rummaged through the family's belongings after murdering all of them. Reportedly, he only took 150,000 yen, which is about $1,000 US. So not that much money. And it's like this person could have also tied them up. They could have brought something, you know, they could have brought rope or something and tied the whole family up, robbed the house, concealed their identity, and then escaped.
Sure.
Probably got away with it as well without having to kill everybody. So it's just, it's weird to me that they escalated to such violence so quickly.
Yeah.
And then thought about what to steal after the fact.
Yeah.
Because when the investigators actually looked through the home, almost double that amount was left behind at the scene.
So they didn't even get all the money.
No, no. Yeah. And then they left their own belongings behind, which really is something you don't see ever. You know, most people who are doing something like this are trying to go in and out without a trace, and there's just very little evidence. But the fact that this person left behind literally every piece of evidence you possibly can.
Yeah.
I think really lends to the inexperience of this individual.
And possibly just the psychosis.
Right.
Like what? Also, you're leaving what they said the jacket was like 1 in 130. So it was maybe like, you know, a fairly nice jacket. So you steal money and then you leave like a nice jacket behind. What?
Not only that, to leave poop behind.
Yeah.
Saliva. Like so stool. Much evidence. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's. No experienced criminal is going to leave that much DNA sample behind purposely.
Unless if they're trying to make a statement of like, you'll never catch me.
Could be.
Could be like that.
Or they're really high on something.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
They're just out of their right mind that they aren't thinking through. They might be having a psychotic episode for all I know. Others believe the perpetrator was a serial killer who hasn't been caught, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
Because I think due to the horrific nature of the crimes, the stabbings, the killing, it seems like the killer had extreme homicidal urges. Because not only did he murder an entire family, including children, but he also remained in the house afterwards. Which, you know, I just said that I think it might be, everything kind of lends it to somebody being inexperienced. But I think in the same token, you could say the fact that they stayed there so long after, that they were so comfortable and confident after doing all that, could also make you go the other way.
Yeah. Yep.
Because, yeah, to use their things to make food, eat their ice cream.
While the bodies are there, yeah, too.
There's just, yeah, it's just, it also shows a complete lack of remorse. And they're clearly not terrified themselves by what they just did, but the fact that there's a dead family there, blood everywhere.
And they're just eating ice cream.
So that could also lend to maybe this is somebody who's experienced, who has done this before, and it just doesn't bother them.
Yeah.
They don't even think about it.
Yeah.
The investigation also noted that the women in the family seemed to have more violence inflicted upon them. Both Yasko and Nina's remains showed severe stab wounds, including Yasko's defensive wounds. It was also concluded that the killer continued to beat Nina after she died, which caused her to lose her teeth and have severe hemorrhaging in her head. The killer seemed to direct his murderous rage specifically at the female members of the family.
Which, I mean, we've kind of seen things like this where a specific person is targeted or, you know, a specific type of people is targeted. So that this does kind of align with the serial killer here.
It does. Some have pointed out that the perpetrator had no known criminal history and hasn't been caught for any crime that the Tokyo Metro Police are aware of. Which, possibly, if they are from Tokyo, I mean, we don't know. They may have been in and out,
yeah,
all we know.
They talked, I know they communicated with other law enforcements where they were suspecting the criminal could have been from. But even the, I believe he was a chief of one of the police stations that worked on the case, later said, kind of lost in translation, Japan is very isolated, kind of by design. They like it that way. And so their kind of lack of interest in reaching out beyond Japan maybe hindered this investigation quite a bit.
Because you think you'd reach out to other countries you may have thought this person traveled from. You close your own borders down. You really try to get the word out or see if there's similar crimes committed in other places. You know, through other international law enforcement agencies. But yeah, seems like they just kind of kept it to themselves too, for the most part. A 2020 study showed that more than half of serial killers have a past criminal history, often tied to burglary and rape. Covered a lot of serial killers on the show, and it's definitely a true statement. An FBI study showed that only 21.7% of murderers did not have a criminal record before their first murder. So
kind of rare here.
Yeah. Still a possibility. Another theory is the revenge killing theory. Many dispute this theory since the family was generally liked by everyone who knew them and there were no known grievances with anyone. The only known grievance that investigators were aware of was that Mikio had gotten into an argument with the noisy local skaters at the skate park near his home a few days before the murders. The theory is that one of the skaters, out of retaliation, killed the entire family.
Yeah, that seems a bit excessive.
Which is hard to imagine.
Yeah. I mean, unless if one of the skaters was a psychotic killer and that maybe
it's possible. Triggered that. Absolutely.
Maybe.
I mean, if you think about it, you look at all the clothing that was left behind the scene. They chalk that up to potentially skaters would be wearing similar clothing
or baggy clothes. Yeah.
But I think the biggest thing is the grip tape.
Yeah.
That's pretty telling.
Yeah.
People don't just carry around grip tape.
No, they don't. Honestly.
That's such a specific thing that only a skateboarder would have on them. It's just like, why did they go that route? Like, you find grip tape. Like, that's so specific that you go find every skateboarder in the vicinity. And
I know they did interview quite a lot of the skaters over there in the park. It just led
nowhere.
But in
the sand.
Yeah. It's California.
So it's like, is it a skateboarder visiting the area?
Possibly.
Knew this was like a hot spot for skating and they're from the States or something.
Possibly.
Or it is somebody from Japan and they went and visited California. I don't know.
And if they're a skater, they could be under 18 and that could be why they don't have the fingerprints.
True.
It's a lot of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very possible. Again, absolutely brutal crime for a first time offender
for
or
a
somebody.
Child?
Who's,
yeah.
Yeah. To do that. Some tie this in with the taxicab eyewitness who had picked up three men on the night of the murders. Two of them might have stood watch while the third committed the killings, which is very possible. Police also interviewed many people from the skate park, but their inquiries led nowhere. which isn't all that surprising. I mean, they're already like getting in trouble for skating as it is. That's just kind of like skate culture too. It's like you kind of just like, you don't help police, you don't help law enforcement, but you would think in this case, you got kids dead.
Horrific, yeah.
That crime. They would try to do everything they can to figure out, or like, no, this wasn't us.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just all very sketchy.
Yeah, and kind of what Josh hinted at a little bit ago, many point to the trace amounts of California City sand inside that hip bag as crucial pieces of evidence there. And this begged the question, where was this guy from? Where was the killer from? Because as the theory goes, the killer might have been the son of a soldier who married a foreign woman while on deployment, considering his mixed ancestry profile, and the killer possibly grew up in Japan and might have been familiar with the area. Many have suggested that from the sand and the ancestry, the killer possibly had a connection with a foreign military, specifically the U.S. military. Because people connected that the sand could have been from the area near the Edwards Air Force Base in the Mojave Desert, north of Los Angeles, close to where they were saying the California City. The idea is that the sand could have been picked up through various activities at the airbase, and then this specific guy was moved to the Yokota Air Base in Honshu, Japan. This was actually about an hour away from the family's home. Considering that the killer was most likely very fit to be able to climb into the window and murder everyone with his hands or a knife, this also fits the profile of a potential military member, and the suggested age range between 15 and 35 would also generally fit a military man. Some have tried to discredit this theory by pointing out that the killer, if he was a member of the U.S. military, would have had to have known the Japanese language since he went through family documents in the computer, but for all we know, you know, the killer could have known Japanese, especially since the ancestry test showed he could have been Japanese. Others critique how there is no motive for this type of killing and the evidence is mostly circumstantial, but regardless, this has become a pretty popular theory. You'll see it online a lot for internet sleuths. And moving on to another theory.
Which I was just going to say, I think that's very valid theory.
Yeah, I mean, military, that's, you travel around the world.
You may have killed before.
True, yeah.
You would have the hand-to-hand skills to take people down.
Yeah, you got basic training.
But I just am like, why?
Yeah, like why out here too? Like an hour away from the base? Was he a military member that was also into skating and had some free time and was over there for whatever reason? And yeah. I don't know. I mean,
I think this just feels too sinister.
Right?
Yeah. It just feels like this has got to be somebody more like experienced.
Targeting them.
Yeah, just premeditated this more.
Yeah.
Rather than like, oh, you know, screw that guy who's yelling us for skating. Like, I'm going to go murder his whole family.
Right. That doesn't seem to
happen. Could it happen? Sure. But it feels like it's kind of far-fetched. But
yeah. Another theory suggested that the family was murdered by a South Korean ex-military hitman who was hired by the local government or the company that was developing the neighborhood and the park. Investigative journalist Fumiya Ichihashi advocated for this theory in their book about the crime, and I believe that's only a pen name, not a real name, but the idea is that the powers that be wanted to expedite the family moving out of the home. But even though the family had already agreed, Yasuko had delayed the move for the sake of her children, if you remember. So they decided to murder them. Another idea is that the hitman was ordered to steal back compensation money for the agreed upon move, but only the equivalent of about $1,000 US was stolen from the home, leaving roughly another $1,000-$2,000 behind. And the hitman is guessed to be Korean because of the ancestry test and that shoe size, if you remember, that is very specific to Korea. He's also proposed to be ex-military because of the Californian sand, possibly connected to that military base we mentioned earlier. The fingerprints found at the scene did not match any in the Korean databases, if you remember. Again, this would mean that the killer was not born in nor could have visited Korea. I believe he must have been a child, but that doesn't make any sense because, what, he was 16 and also ex-military? It doesn't really add up. And this theory is seen as improbable by many, since all of the remaining people who lived in the neighborhood had agreed to move out at some point, Plus, why would a hitman brutalize the mother and her daughter, which made the murders seem personal? On top of that, why would a hitman leave fingerprints, blood, and stool, as well as countless items behind? And why would he stay inside the home after the murders? Plus, if you remember this, if this was a professional hitman, why would he bring a weapon that would so easily break on his first victim with the knife? That also doesn't make sense. So the hitman's strategy is sloppy, extremely aggressive, and also, you know, terrible for the community. What they want, somebody to move out of this area so they kill the whole family, or they want some money back so they kill the whole family, doesn't really make sense.
It feels like it's plausible, but feels highly unlikely to me.
Yeah. If they're hired by the local government or whatever, it's like, we're building a park for you guys. Why would we do something like this?
Yeah, I don't know.
But I mean, if that didn't tell you enough, one of the lead investigators who we mentioned earlier, Takeshi Tsuchida, disputes this theory. And about the book, he said, it's 100% nonsense. If the book was true, the criminal would have been caught. It's okay if it was a fictional novel, but I have strong doubts calling it nonfiction. So that's one of the lead investigators on the case. Yeah. Another theory suggests that a worker from a local meat shop committed the murders, and this anonymous man was 20 years old at the time of the crime and 5'7", which matches the physical profile of the murderer. And he was seen by a witness the day after the murders, a few miles from the scene, walking his dog. He was also seen with a bandage on his hand. He also had a BMX bike and was wearing a hat similar to the one left behind. He was also suspected of previously robbing from his boss, and police interviewed that man, but he was never arrested, and that investigation into that man led nowhere. The podcast Faceless, which covered the crime in depth, was created by a guy named Nicholas Obregon, who has spent over a decade researching this case, and he proposes that the killer was actually a 13-year-old connected to 2chan.
Okay, I gotta hear this.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. So, in a 2chan thread posted 3 days before the murders, the user, Mr. Kuromutsu, explained that ever since he was 3 years old, he would engage in animal cruelty, including stabbing rats to death. He also admitted to killing cats and dogs and abusing them as well. If you want to read the whole post, it's right there, and you can see it's dated December 27th, 2000. The user also claimed that he wanted to kill his neighbors the same way as the Oita family murder case. And this case involved a 15-year-old boy attacking a family of six with a knife. So a very similar case to this one. And in August 2000, he killed three and left three in critical condition after he was accused of being a peeping Tom. Japan had also seen a recent rise in violent crimes by teenagers around this time. So it's not exactly out of the question. The user also specified that he wanted to kill them before the 21st century arrives, which is exactly when the murder occurred. But he did say that the date of the quote-unquote event was December 31st at 11:59 p.m., which really doesn't add up because the Miyazawa family, they were murdered 3 days later on the 30th, so not exactly when this poster was saying. The user later explained in a post on February 4th, 2001, that he had recently been on a trip, which maybe this trip was talking about going to Japan. The theory caught the attention of investigators, and since the killer claimed to be 13 years old, he most likely would not have shown up in their databases, especially the South Korean one.
I'll buy that.
Yeah. People also pointed out that the last meal of the killer before the murders, which if you remember contained string beans and sesame seeds, were common ingredients in home-cooked meals that used the previously mentioned ingredients, plus soy sauce and sometimes sugar. Specifically, this is a meal that Japanese mothers would often cook their children. So that kind of tracks a little bit. Some have pointed out holes in this theory, though, like the date mentioned in the post was incorrect, and also that the family didn't have many neighbors, considering that they were the last few in the area, along with Yasuko's mother. And the user also never used anyone's specific names. It was kind of just a general idea of wanting to kill a family. I was also thinking about this too. Do you know any 13-year-olds who are 5'7"? Doesn't that seem a bit tall for 13? I guess if you hit your growth spurt a bit early,
I think
early,
it's possible.
Maybe. On top of this, why would a 13-year-old have Californian sand in his hip bag?
Unless they had been there.
Yeah, possibly.
Could this be a child of somebody on the military base or?
Maybe. And then it's also questioned, how could a 13-year-old have the strength to climb into that window and overpower the entire family
yeah.
being attacked? That's a bit less believable. I think Mikio would have been able to overtake a 13-year-old.
I mean,
he does have a knife.
A raging 13-year-old with a big old sashimi yeah. knife. I mean, it's possible, I feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there's some big 13-year-olds.
There are.
It is possible.
There's definitely some 13-year-olds. I'm like, you look a lot older
some
than
yoked
that.
13-year-olds
yeah,
out there.
There's definitely yeah. some that hit the puberty a little early.
Some of those corn-fed ones.
Yeah. Like good old Nebraskan boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My hang up is that on 2chan, people talking about killing people, I'm like, that's just another Saturday, right?
Someplace
like 2chan. I mean, it does kind of add up, but.
But is a 13-year-old going to be able to evade 250,000 officers from
right,
finding
yeah.
them? Like, what kind of mastermind criminal is that?
Yeah, and if they're that young, you would think they would do something
they
like
tell
that.
Tell somebody.
Or like it would just get out
Yo,
somehow.
Guess what I did this week? You
right,
know what I mean? Like
yeah,
kids are
absolutely.
Dumb. They'd say some dumb shit to somebody.
Absolutely.
There's no way this person gets away yeah. for years.
Which we'll see in a future case, actually. It's the same deal. It's like they're teenagers are dumb as hell. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it's an interesting theory, but it seems like it's mainly based on the poop. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like their biggest evidence here is the poop had common, but I'm like, sesame seeds and string beans are probably in so many meals
yeah.
that
yeah.
it could be breakfast, lunch, or dinner. There's
right.
sesame seeds and
yeah.
food. You know what I mean?
It's also like, okay, it's a common home cooked meal for mothers to feed their children. But like, I would eat that soy sauce and string beans.
Especially
and,
if you're traveling. It's
yeah, this is a pretty simple meal.
And the other thing that makes that even worth considering is the fact that there wouldn't have been any DNA to connect it to, because that person was a minor.
Right.
And I think that's it.
Yeah.
But I'm like, this yeah. could also be somebody who was just visiting, that was just there, that just happened to be there. Because again, how do you explain the Californian sand?
Yeah.
If it's like a local 13-year-old teenager, where's the sand from?
But then it's like, how did he get South Korean sneakers? Who is this kid?
Yeah.
Like, how
yeah.
is that
right.
possible?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe it's like a kid whose dad has some crazy connections that travels a lot. I don't know.
I mean, this might be a stupid question, but can you, if you're in Japan, could you just order the sneakers from Korea?
I think I don't know. Well, this is 2000. Not many stores had online shops at
That's
that
true.
Rate. And it said specifically they were manufactured and sold only in Korea.
Okay. Yeah.
So it could have been a family member who traveled there.
Mm-hmm.
The military service angle is interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because it feels like, especially since they were able to trace that sand back to Edwards Air Force Base, that's interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because what are the chances that this is just some rando tourist or something? It feels to me like there is some military angle here, and whether it be a military member's son, daughter,
yeah.
or the actual military member themselves, I mean, it could be a young 18-year-old, but I mean, it's just like,
also could have been like military man who was maybe stationed in Korea for a little bit, bought those shoes as a Christmas gift
yeah.
for their kid. That could have been how they got out of the country, and then it ended up on a 13-year-old's feet, and he was like, hey, check out these cool
and I wonder
South Korean
if
shoes.
You're in the military and you're being stationed in Korea, if you're even like following the fingerprinting thing and like having to like check in with customs that same way.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? If you're just going to a military base, because it's kind of a different situation. So maybe you would never even be giving.
Yeah, I don't know. Do they
fingerprints or.
Do we even have Air Force bases in South Korea? We
oh,
must.
Oh, yes, for
we
sure.
We must. But I wonder if they treat military members the same way. Because I know it's if you're a citizen and if you're a tourist over 17. But I don't know about military members.
That's what I'm saying is like if you. It's a different process.
We should look that up, actually. We should see if we could find that.
While in general, foreigners entering South Korea in the 2000s likely had biometrics taken at ports, U.S. soldiers stationed there under Statute of Forces Agreement, especially around 2000, were a part of a unique status, but they still needed fingerprints for military and security purposes.
Yeah, but does that, and that's in South Korea's database?
That's in South Korea. I don't know if it is in South Korea's database.
Because that's the thing is, I'm like, do the Korean authorities have access to all of the service members' fingerprints?
I mean, from what I'm looking at, it looks like they did have to give biometrics, but it was handled by the USFK. So I don't know if local law enforcement could get that information, but it seems like this is a case where they probably would
share that
information. So I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, I feel like if this is even remotely a possibility, that there could be something where the Japanese authorities aren't getting access to Korean databases or the actual service members' biometric data. Because I just have a hard time thinking that if it isn't somebody outside of Japan, how 250,000 investigators that worked on this case weren't able to find anybody within their own country. Japan's not that big of a country either. Right. And with that amount of time and effort put into this case, if it was somebody from Japan, I feel like they would have figured it out.
Especially with how much DNA was left.
Right. Well, the thing that gets me is like, this almost feels like somebody who goes into this knowing that the chances of me getting caught are slim to none. And if I'm playing the service member, like this is a US service member, maybe even a different, it could even be some other country service member that happened to be stationed in Japan for all we know, that maybe this was just, maybe this could have been a hate crime. I mean, this could have been somebody who had something against Japanese people, and this family was their opportunity. They saw this family, they were skateboarding over there. They saw this family. It just pissed them off one day and they're like, this guy's going down. Yeah. And then they went in and everybody else was kind of a sort of just a casualty, but they were going after Mikio possibly. And ultimately they just hated the family and Mikio because of their race. I mean, for all we know, it could be something along those lines. Because it's just so brutal.
I think that's more of a plausible explanation than a failed break-in and a failed robbery, honestly.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's crazy because the police never made an arrest relation to this, which is absolutely insane to me. I mean, from everything that I know, the Japanese authorities are on it. I mean, they're dealing with the Yakuza and, you know, they have all sorts of organized crime and all sorts of other things.
Especially considering how high profile this case was.
Yeah.
It's like all eyes were on this
case.
You
want to solve this.
Yeah.
And just the amount of evidence, there's thousands of officers. It went cold. They like could not solve it. And they still don't even have a motive. And obviously there's just questions, you know, as we're talking about, there's just questions. But yeah, they had 15,000 tips from the public, 250,000 investigators worked. I mean, that's a lot of manpower. It's a lot of brain power. Every resource exhausted on the DNA, and the DNA is not coming back to anybody. Just doesn't make sense.
No.
In 2019, 72-year-old retired detective Takeshi Tsuchida expressed how he still couldn't let go of the case and how could you? He worked as the chief at the Seijo police station. The facial expression of the family members remains sealed in his memory, and he said, "They have furious facial expressions. They are mortified and regretful. I imagine that all the victims felt the same way, just feeling regret." He still meets with Mikio's mother regularly. He reluctantly had to give up on the case and retire after 41 years working in law enforcement. He said, "Unless there's a miracle and the criminal surrenders himself or his fingerprints match, if he commits another crime, I believe there is no chance he will be arrested."
Damn.
Which says so much. It's like, he also said Japanese police are not great with international cooperative investigations because of a lack of experience and language skills. So that's my thing too, is it feels to me like whoever did this
was not from Japan.
Yeah.
And that they knew they were getting out of the country, hence why they weren't worried about leaving all this DNA, all this evidence. They're casually doing their thing in there because they knew, I'm going to be gone here and they're never going to know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to come up in their systems, nothing. Mm-hmm. It's just like a random crime of opportunity and I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, this case kind of does read like an American serial killer case, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah.
Like, I could totally buy that he wasn't from Japan.
I'm curious, what is the number one murder weapon for Japanese murders?
Oh, it's probably knife, right?
What kind of knife? Like, how many murders in Japan happen with sashimi knives? I'm curious because I'm wondering if that is a common weapon used.
Yeah, also, why, if it wasn't American, why would he have a sashimi knife? Unless he just picked it up randomly. Yeah.
Picked up at any shop, probably.
I would.
Yeah. The case is now led by Manabu Ide from the Tokyo Metropolitan Police Special Investigative Task Force. And he's actually confident. He believes that this case, among others, will eventually be solved. And as a result of public outcry, the statute of limitations for murder was removed in potential death penalty cases so that work on the case could continue. That's
pretty crazy.
That is crazy. Yeah. I'm glad they did that, though. Mm-hmm. And after 19 years of preserving the house for more possible evidence, it was finally announced it would be torn down. Investigators claimed all the evidence had been taken, analyzed, even replicated. The victim's family and supporters pushed for the home to remain, so it did. In 2023, the home was broken into by 10 high school students, so new signs and guards were posted. The home still stands, though.
Isn't that crazy?
Sealed up with 24/7 guard patrols and has continued to fall apart. That's pretty nuts. You don't see that.
Yeah.
A scene like this. Eventually, a house here in America would just be torn down
or
not guarded like this.
This also completely debunks the hitman theory where it's like they were doing it to get the family out of the house because that
backfired.
Yeah, because the house is still there.
In January 2025, the group Sora Nokai submitted a petition to the Japanese government, and this petition advocated for the establishment of laws governing the use of DNA information in criminal investigations. The new approach would be similar to cases like the Golden State Killer, where advanced DNA analysis played a crucial role in solving the crime. And currently, Japan's use of DNA information is limited to basic individual identification. It mostly uses DNA samples from a crime scene to identify a suspect or victim. But this would expand DNA usage, especially for cold cases. So they're not, it seems like they're not quite as far along with, you know, genealogy and DNA testing.
I think they're also very hung up on privacy.
Yeah.
It's like a big word there.
They don't have the same like databases, you know.
Us Americans, we give our data and personal information, biometrics away.
CODIS like and all these other databases that we have.
Yeah.
That they can just start matching it to, and they're not, you know, swabbing prisoners and all these other things. We definitely are leading in a lot of ways when it comes to the DNA profiling, but the 93-year-old paternal grandmother of the children, Setsuko, continues to advocate for the family. She watched the children for 2 days every week while their parents work, so this is absolutely devastating. And she holds on to the many fond memories of her family. She probably never thought she'd outlive her entire family and grandkids. She said, "I want to know the truth. Why did the murder happen? Why did my very young grandchildren have to be killed?" She also said, "I always wonder how they would have been grown up. My biggest regret is that I never got to see them grow up." She cannot remember the family's funeral either. She was so upset that she couldn't walk and had to be carried into the service. And today she keeps a shrine to her family in her home and she prays to them. She still hopes that they will one day receive answers, that whoever did this will be held responsible. And I think ultimately she just wants to know why. Why did this have to happen? It's truly... it's just sad. I mean, it's horrible. This is a young family just living their lives, just being completely normal.
Have we ever seen a case like this with such ample evidence left behind that was not solved? So.
And that's why I'm just like, this person was either out of their mind.
I kind of tend to think that's what's going on.
In the middle of a psychotic episode, they weren't thinking through anything.
Yeah.
And they just went and did this and then left. Or it was somebody who knew they weren't going to be there and there'd be no way to trace it back to them.
Yeah.
And
it does come off like a serial killing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, especially like abusing someone after they're already dead, a child to that as well. That seems like serial killer behavior right there.
And even in some cases, serial killers won't even touch children like that.
True. Yeah.
Like that's especially brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of serial killers that did serve in the armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we covered that serial killer episode, they were, military was up there.
Dennis Rader.
Oh, yeah.
Dahmer, yep. Ridgway.
Yeah.
Berkowitz.
All the big ones. Holy yeah. shit.
Randy yeah. Kraft. John Allen Muhammad. I mean, there's tons that were the military veterans. Because to me, it's like, I have a hard time, especially believing that this was just like a teenager that just raged out and
yeah,
brutally murdered a family with a knife. It does happen. We've covered some cases where teenagers are like 13, like somebody super young. I don't know. Yeah, it's pot. It's either it was a minor of some sort, had a criminal record, just snapped, did this, somehow has evaded showing up on police's radar
forever.
Just,
yeah,
this was it. One years. And done. They just did this and then never did another thing. So they're, that's wild to me. The chances of that happening, I feel like, are very slim, but
no, if anything, in a lot of our cases that we cover like this, it escalates. It continues to get worse until
you do something like this. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense.
No.
You have any different theories? Where do you kind of land with this, Danny?
I mean, the idea of the 13-year-old on 2chan, I don't agree with that specific theory, but I can kind of see like a disgruntled military child doing something like this, because I know a lot of people tend to think like, oh, a child could never do this. I think on this show, we've seen that that's just false. We've seen that children are capable of very horrific things. The only thing that leads me to think it's not a child is how they got away with it. Because every time a child does this, I mean, it's...
Yeah, they always get caught.
Kids are stupid. Yeah. Like, and so they do these horrible things and they get caught super fast. So this one's weird to me. I kind of like... I don't like the idea, but I kind of agree with your idea that it was more of a hate crime. So to me, in my mind, what I think is it's a child in a military family. They travel around a lot, probably into skateboarding around that same age. Probably into like, if they've been in Japan for a little bit of time, they've probably gotten into like the streetwear style, which would explain the clothes, everything like that. It would explain the grip tape if they're skating. And then they might not like Japanese people.
It's just the rage you would need.
Exactly.
To injure yourself, to use that knife, to do all the things that they did, to kill children, kids that are defenseless. It just seems like, I don't know. I also have a hard time believing this is some professional either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A professional would not be this messy at all.
Right. Or it would, like we were saying, it would have to be messy on purpose.
Right.
Or it would be like they're leaving this sand and this, all their clothing behind be, to though. Be like a what red herring.
What if
like,
it was?
Like all this is planted there to confuse investigators. It would have to be like something like that if it was an actual genius, quote unquote, killer, you know?
But they left their DNA, and that's just something professional hitmen don't do.
No.
Exactly.
That's why hitmen...
A stool sample?
Yeah.
Like eating food? Like, the salat? Like, that's just so
what
much.
What kind of weirdo hitman is this? Yeah. No, I don't buy the hitman theory.
Either.
It just feels like my gut tells me this is somebody who was there for a brief time and knew they were leaving.
Saw the opportunity.
Knew there was nothing on them in their databases. So even if they left, even they got their DNA, there was no matches that were going to come back.
Sure.
And this feels, I just am struggling with motive. The motive other than
nothing.
They just hated them Rage. For their race or something like that. Or hated them because they yelled, like Mikio yelled at them for skateboarding. Like, that just seems insane to me. So I'm struggling with motive still. I don't know.
Maybe it's just a disturbed person. Yeah. Maybe that's all it took to set them off, possibly. Yeah.
Something snapped. They've been thinking about killing somebody for a while, then they just went nuts. Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely a mystery. But let us know what you think. I want to know what theory makes the most sense to you, or if there's one that maybe we didn't mention. I'm curious. But I hope that with the technology and the fact that we do have so much DNA that one day we might get an answer as to who is responsible for this. I hope they're preserving all of that. And I mean, the fact that they're even preserving the house gives me hope that the rest of the evidence is being preserved and may one day unlock the mystery.
I kind of agree with that. The retired officer that he said, it's either someone has to come forward or they have to commit another crime to where we finally connect like their fingerprints and DNA. Because otherwise, I don't know, 25 years.
It's a long time, man.
Yeah.
But that's going to be it for us today. Appreciate you for being here. If you enjoy the work that we do, we appreciate it if you like or subscribe or follow, depending on what platform you're listening on. Really appreciate it. But we'll see you guys next week with another one. Till then, lights out, everybody.